This is Frankly MSP, where managed service providers get real.
Hey, and welcome to episode 32 of Frankly MSP, the podcast for managed service providers who want to boost their productivity, efficiency, and profitability. I'm your host, Jennifer Tribe. We've got a great show lined up for you today. If you like this episode, and I hope you do, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. A hat tip this week to Joe IT, who left us a 5-star review on iTunes saying, "Great ideas for MSP owners. I own an MSP, and I have made this podcast part of my regular schedule." So thank you for that, Joe IT. Well, today I'm going to be talking to Ross Slater, who is partner and VP at a company in Toronto called Reach Capabilities. Reach works with leadership teams to cultivate personal and professional growth, which typically involves leveraging tools like the one we're going to talk about today that improve communication, efficiency, and productivity. Those are words that are music to our ears here at Frankly MSP. The tool we're going to be exploring is the Colby Index. A couple of episodes ago, you may remember I interviewed Cindy Perks of Outsourced Help Desk GMS about her hiring practices and how GMS scaled their technical team from 30 to 130 employees. The Colby Index was one of the tools that she mentioned, but we didn't get a chance to do much more than mention it in that interview because we were focused on other aspects of the hiring process. But I thought it was worth bringing back and doing a deeper dive because Colby is a tool that I'm familiar with, that I've used quite a bit, as you'll hear in the interview, and I've found it tremendously helpful as a way to better know myself and the ways I can best accomplish things, but it's also been a great way to understand fellow team members, how to communicate with others, how to set people up for success and play to their strengths. And it can also be used, as we heard from Cindy, in the hiring process with great results. Ross and I will talk about all of that and how it can really help you cultivate a happy and productive team within your MSP. But before we get to that, however, we turn to what's going on for a look at current news and events through an MSP lens. Richard Tubb and Carl Palachuk are back in front of the mic for this episode, so let's hear what they have to say.
You're listening to Frankly MSP, brought to you by Avic Networks.
Hi, folks. I'm Nigel Moore, and I'm at home here in Newcastle upon Tyne in crappy weather. And I'm joined today by Jamie Warner, who is somewhere much hotter and nicer.
Exactly.
I am not Nigel Moore, and that is not Jamie Warner. It's true that I'm at home in Newcastle upon Tyne in fairly awful weather, but I am joined by Carl Palachuk, my really good friend across in Sacramento, California, where I presume it's a lot nicer there, Carl.
It is a lot nicer, although we're at the tail end of this really smoky weather. So I was in Australia last month and actually did an event with Nigel, and several people talked to me at a couple different dinner events about the Avic podcast. So there's actually a decent following down there. So I was quite impressed.
Yeah. And I guess we should explain for anybody who was first to this episode. Yeah, Nigel and Jamie actually hosted What's Going On last week and did a bang up job of doing impressions of you and I, Carl. So I thought it was only fair that we do our best and try for an Australian accent. Well, you said you've been doing a little bit of traveling over in Australia. I want to kick things off this week by talking about some traveling that I've done. I was most recently traveling at DatoCon 18 in Barcelona, where bizarrely, I had the pleasure of seeing Avic founder and VP Alex Hoff take to the stage dressed in a polar bear outfit.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so the man knows how to roll there. Unbelievably, though, that wasn't the biggest talking point coming out of DatoCon 18, Carl. The big news was that Datto CEO Austin McCord has resigned from the company he founded more than a decade ago. The news of McCord's resignation came just a few days before he was due to keynote DatoCon 18 in Barcelona. He did go ahead and keynote it, and it was really quite an emotional send-off for a CEO who I think has built an amazingly positive reputation in the industry and amongst his own staff. So the crux of McCord's decision was that Datto's plans for 2019 and beyond are to head towards an IPO, and he didn't feel as though he was the person to take the company on this journey. In fact, during his keynote, Austin gave a history of Datto's growth, and it was clear that he's put an incredible amount of time, energy, and sacrifices to grow the business to where it is today. And you and I both know, Carl, that sort of effort might be achievable over the short term, but it probably isn't sustainable over a very long period of time. So what Austin McCord has done is he's handed the reins across, in the interim at least, to Chief Financial Officer Tim Weller. It's also worth noting, I think, that a life event can really change things and change your perspective. And Austin McCord's great friend and the head of Datto in the UK, Andrew Stewart, who sadly passed away earlier this year, I think that's going to give anyone a different perspective on what's important. Certainly from my own perspective, it was my own father passing that was the catalyst for me selling my MSP business, for instance.
That's a pretty common thing that happens. I had a friend who recently, a year ago, had a life-threatening health event and just decided, you know, I don't need to be driving 2 hours to go see clients. I'm going to completely change my business. And so it's a very common thing.
It is. So I think there's a number of things in there. Obviously, Datto, huge MSP vendor in the industry, very well known, very well liked. Lots of the listeners to this podcast will be using their tools. So Austin McCord stepping down did come as a shock. But as somebody who openly talks about relax, focus, succeed, Carl, what do you make about this big announcement? Because, you know, McCord talked about working 15, 16 hours days, and he's done it for the last 11 years. This is a big change for him.
It is. What's interesting is that my first perspective was not from the work-life balance, because that was so clearly part of the story. My reaction was from the perspective of having worked with many companies that had emerged from early startup all the way to IPO. The team that gets you to one point can't get you to the next major point. And so even if he wanted to stay, you've seen this with many of your friends and colleagues and people you've worked with over the years, that when you get to the point where you need to either take on extra funding, move to the next level, or go IPO, what happens is there has to be a turnover of the leadership. In some ways, it's almost required by the system. It's rare for somebody to take a company from founding to major funding to super success to IPO. It's almost unheard of. Mm. And in some ways, he's lucky that at this point in his life, he has the opportunity to do that, and that it's going to create a very smooth transition. I have met Austin, I don't really know him, but he clearly is somebody who's going to be around for as whatever they need, he's going to be there for them. But he also acknowledges that when you go to the stage where you're going to be ready for IPO, you have to turn it over to somebody who does that, not just somebody who is a good friend or that, you know, they've done well for the company. There's a real strategy in getting to the next level, and it doesn't happen by itself.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. One of my mentors, Arlen Sorensen, a great friend of yours as well, I know, talked to me in the past about leaders who can take a business to one level can't necessarily take the business to the next level. So is there a lesson in here for the founders of MSP businesses who have perhaps reached an impasse? They don't seem to be able to get across a hurdle to grow the business to the next level. Is there a lesson that they can take here that perhaps they need to stand aside and let somebody else do the work?
Well, certainly one of the things that holds many MSPs back is their unwillingness to turn over certain things to somebody else. I mentioned to you before we started recording, I'm going to my chiropractor this afternoon. This guy's been my chiropractor for like literally 20 years, and he still doesn't have a receptionist. And every time I go in there, I think, if you would just give up this tiny little piece of your authority, you can make more money because you don't have to sit at the front desk, answer the phone, make appointments, do the billing, you know, and he's decided he doesn't want to. But it's the same thing with MSPs. The people who never hire a receptionist, they never hire an administrative assistant. They don't hand off the tech support to somebody else because nobody could do it as well as they can. And so they end up working 60-hour weeks.
Exactly. And we see it at all levels, don't we? We see it as a one-man band. They're not willing to give up responsibility for some of the things they either feel comfortable doing or indeed they like doing. Nobody can do it as well as me. They keep themselves. That prevents them from growing. Certainly, I see it with businesses, most typically here in the UK, perhaps managed service providers who are between sort of 900,000 and 1.3 million and they keep yo-yoing backwards and forwards between those two areas. And I think it's specifically because the business owner is not equipped to take them to the next level, to enable them to stretch outside their comfort zone.
It's true. And on rare occasions, you'll find an owner who, and I just did some coaching with somebody who's right in the $6 million range. And basically, he found somebody who was better than he was at running the actual operations. And he literally just turned that person over to be the operations manager. And now he's the owner and he does the sales, but he doesn't run the company. And that's hard. I mean, when you grow something for 10 years, your ego is kind of built into that business. And so it's really hard to turn it over and say, I trust somebody enough to let them actually run my business.
Absolutely. Well, we wish Austin McCord, the outgoing CEO of Datto, all the best for the future. I'm positive we're going to see more of him popping up around the industry. There is a man who knows the MSP space very, very well. But want to go from one story about people's goals for life to a life sentence, Carl. Tell us about this story that has really tickled me, and perhaps all in the wrong ways, but tell us a little bit more about this.
So EMR is electronic medical records, and the EMR and HIPAA website had an article written by our friend Mike Semmel about this incident where in New Jersey, this one company had mishandled medical records, and then they had some basically the really sloppy procedures. And so the state attorney general not only convicted them on the HIPAA violation, but also called it consumer fraud for allowing these 1,650 records to be made public and accidentally posted on the internet. And so there was a $200,000 fine. And then the service provider, which is basically a medical transcriptionist, had to agree as part of the settlement that they would have a permanent ban on managing or owning a business in the state of New Jersey.
Forgive me for laughing, because this is not, obviously this is serious, but really a life sentence for a HIPAA violation.
Yes. Of course, the graphic that they put with this is this guy behind bars in a suit looking very sad. But it's funny because with both GDPR, HIPAA, and now many of the states and almost every country is adopting some kind of similar laws about public records and private records. You get to keep your private stuff private. I think that we need to develop a way to make this information unusable. That's my personal opinion. But in the meantime, we as technology professionals have a responsibility to take this very, very seriously. Because the IT people are the ones who manage the databases. We manage whether or not it's encrypted. We manage whether or not the people are trained and whether it's documented. And that's a piece of every one of these laws. Because you can follow all the rules, but if you don't document it, you're still not in compliance.
In the article, Mike actually says, what are the lessons we can learn? Well, he says, have your servers installed by a certified professional using a detailed checklist. Do you know anybody who produced checklists for this type of thing, Carl?
Well, aside from Mike, there's me. The interesting thing is that the article is actually written to health professionals, but I like the article because it's so relevant to us. The more and more people are taking this seriously, and for a long time, people just ignored it. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I got my first GDPR contract, it was about an inch thick. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And so I just ignored it for months until finally it was like, if you want to get paid, you got to sign the paper.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. But it's a very good article, and thanks for picking it up. And I apologize out loud for laughing at the HIPAA life sentence there, but there you go. But yeah, let's draw things to a close here. If you enjoyed this episode, then my name is Richard Tubb and my friend is Carl Palachuk. If you didn't enjoy this episode, then my name is Nigel Moore and that was Jamie Warner. Thanks, Carl. Thanks for joining me again and we'll look forward to speaking to you next time.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Frankly MSP.
As always, I'll put links to the articles Carl and Richard discuss in today's show notes at ovic.com/franklymsp/032. Now we come to my interview with Ross Slater, partner and VP at Reach Capabilities in Toronto. I certainly had a lot of fun recording this interview, and I think there are both interesting and practical takeaways for managers in what we discuss here. So let's go. Hey, Ross, welcome to the Frankly MSP podcast.
Thanks very much, Jen. It's great to be here.
Today, we're going to talk about the Kolbe Index. That's K-O-L-B-E Index. A couple of episodes ago, I had a guest on the show named Cindy Perks, and she was talking about her company, GMS, uses Kolbe when they're hiring new technicians. And I thought, hey, I know a Kolbe expert. His name's Ross Slater. He's been Kolbe certified for 20 years, has worked on, what, tens of thousands of Kolbe indexes with
pretty
people
much
at this point? Yeah. And just recently won the 2018 Kolbe Professional Award, which is a tremendous distinction. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And full disclosure, Ross and I used to be business partners in a company called HighSpot, where we used the Kolbe Index quite a lot. In fact, Ross, you were my first introduction to Kolbe. So I'd never heard of it before I met you. And, you know, I was skeptical at first. I asked you a bunch of questions. I did a bunch of research online. And after I finally took the questionnaire and got my index, you said, of course you did all of that research. You're an 8732. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that story?
I love that you did all that research because it just sort of proved the point about your MO. And it's very common. MO, by the way, is how we often short form the Kolbe Index. And MO just stands for modus operandi or method of operation, because it's about how you go about getting things done, not what you'll choose to do or what you feel is really important, but the methodology and the mental energy you have. And the reason I really wanted you to do your Kolbe was because I needed to know if we were going to be working together, what I could really count on you to do and what really worked really well for you and how to provide you with information and also to know how you were going to interact with me. And I find the language is just so good to be able to share and kind of say, okay, so this is what I do. This is how I do it. Great. And then we really know. It shortens so much of the, yeah, I have to learn by like figuring it out as we go through some sort of challenge or something happens. It's just, it really moves the relationships along really, really quickly. And in fact, what's really funny is I met you through my husband, Wayne Smith, my now husband. At the time we were just dating. About 2 weeks into the process, I'm like, so Wayne, do you think you want to take this to like 20-minute questionnaire? And he was like, sure. And I'm like, awesome. He's interested in personal development, which is really important to me. And number two, now I get to know what's going on with him and how he does things before I get too committed to it. So it was kind of fun that way. And that's what I learned about you with your 8732.
Yeah. So interesting application in dating. I don't know if we're going to talk a lot about that today, but more in the business space, but definitely interesting. So in our business, HighSpot, we had every single client do a Kolbe Index and every single staff member and freelancer we worked with, because we had a small staff, but a large stable of freelancers that we worked with regularly. That was something, having everyone do their Kolbes, that you proposed and initiated. So tell us about your thinking behind that.
And you were really reluctant to do it too. You're like, why are we doing this? It doesn't make any sense. I'm going to tell you why it really worked and what the turning point was for you, because I remember the turning point. We were working with a freelance writer, and they were an initiating action quick start and an initiating action fact finder, and they were a counteract in follow through. I don't remember their exact MO, but it was like that long quick start, long fact finder, and then the short follow through. And I said, really watch working with this person, because they're going to be all over the place. When you give them a deadline, they're going to want an extension to actually kind of negotiate, because they're going to need extra time. And they were working overseas in, I think they were in England at the time. And like Friday, when the deadline for their manuscript was due, they like emailing, could I have the weekend? And I was like, yep, remember? And you went, aha, that's why we want to do that. And I was like, yeah, that's why we want to do that. We want to know what someone's going to be like. So knowing every client allowed us to tailor our communications to them and to know how much structure we needed to provide or how they were going to react and how long a project might take and how they were going to like maybe want to change things and respond. And the exact same way with all our freelancers, that's like to understand how we could manage them really well, or whether there was going to be a challenge managing them, and to put proper extra buffer into certain situations. And I still use some of the people that we had freelance in my business now. And I really think about things like, we have a great graphic designer who's like a one in quick start. And he really turns in things with his long fact finder, his long follow through on time, but he does exactly what we ask for. And we have another designer that's a really long quick start. You ask him for three options and he gives you eight, and they're all completely different. And so when you want to take something and kind of go crazy with it, it's awesome. You get someone who's going to provide more in a different way. And when you want something that has to be really, really structured and systematic and detail-oriented, you use someone different. And it's just really about not the talent that they have for writing or graphic design or anything else, but the way you manage them and how you can interact with them. And I think both of those were really important to our business because, like you said, we were super lean and we had to figure out how to coordinate them and be top priority for them.
Yeah. And we've been talking, you know, throwing out numbers and quick start this and fact finder this. So we've kind of backed into it. But let's look now at what is a Kolbe index exactly?
Sure. Kolbe measures your natural conative energy. And conative is probably a word that you don't even know of, but it's actually a word that goes back about 2,400 years to the ancient philosophers of Greece, of Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates. And what they really looked at was this understanding of the different parts of the human mind. Cognitive is one major one, how smart you are, what information you know, how you process information, how fast. The second part is affective, which is personality and how we actually operate in terms of feelings and values, you know, honesty and all that other interesting stuff. And then the third part of how we operate as human beings is that conative. And Kolbe is the only tool that measures the conative. And when we look at it, what it does is it measures how we go about getting things done, the mental energy we have to solve problems in different ways, not in the way it needs to be solved necessarily, but in the way that's easiest for us. And I often think about my Kolbe as like my height. I happen to be quite tall. I'm about 6'4". And so I think about things that are really great at 6'4" is getting fresh air in crowds because you get kind of headspace, or walking really fast from one street corner to the next when you have to go somewhere. What's really bad about being tall is long legs on planes never really work out. The seats are not built for that. Or clothes off the rack are really hard to get. So it's never a question of what's good or bad. It's more about putting yourself into positions that really work well for you. And Kolbe is a way to measure this third part. It's really the only way to measure this third part of how we operate, our conative instincts.
And I believe that Kolbe is rooted in brain science research. Is that right?
It's really interesting because it's come into the research sort of backwards. Kathy Kolbe really intuited this idea of where it was coming from. Her father is E.F. Wunderlich, who invented the Wunderlich IQ test, and a portion of the family still operates that IQ test. It's been around forever, like 100 years. So she had always understood and come from this point of view of the different aspects. And she said to her dad a long time ago, I think that really smart people aren't always really successful, and really nice people aren't always really successful. There's got to be some other thing. And so she started coming up with a way of figuring out what this other thing was. It's a little bit like watching a swan swim along a lake. You can see the swan moving along, but you don't know what the legs are doing. And what the Kolbe index does is it really measures what the legs are doing underwater of what someone needs to get things done in their own way. And she approached it in a very scientific method, and it's been proven up the wazoo over and over again, including doing some EEG studies where you really look at when someone's in their natural zone doing things, they really have a great way of operating. And when they are having challenges, there's an opposite way of operating that it's not that they can't get it done. Anybody can do virtually anything if they have to. It's the amount of conative stress or challenge it causes them. So there's great studies in this area that really talk about the value of knowing this and putting yourself in the right situations.
So tell us about the four main action modes of Kolbe and what they mean.
The four action modes are called fact finder, which is colored red, and then there's follow through, which is colored blue, and then there's quick start, which is colored green, and implementer, which is colored yellow. Fact finder is how we have to gather and then share information. And we use a similar scale for all four of those action modes, even though they're not correlated. So you were saying you're an 8 in fact finder and a 2 in implementer. It's not like 8 in fact finder can't also be an 8 in implementer, or a 2 in fact finder can't also be a 2 in implementer. They can land anywhere on a 10-point scale of 1 through 10. And then each of the action modes is separate from each other. So fact finder measures our need to gather and then share information. And with your 8 in fact finder, you need a lot of information, you ask a lot of questions, you need a lot of research because you need to be able to justify and prove something to yourself, first of all. And then if anybody ever asks, you can have all this research and proof points and know the details. But someone who's really short on FactFinder wouldn't need to do all that research. they might just need a really quick bottom line. Like, just give me the two bullet points, no more than that. When you move into follow through, it's measuring our need to create structure and systemization. So long follow throughs, like you with your seven, have lists and have processes and follow those processes and really plan things out in a very structured, systematic way. Very, very mindful of the need to bring things to conclusion in a process. Short follow-throughs are like the opposite. They're like circus jugglers juggling multiple things and they drop stuff and it doesn't matter because interruptions and being adaptable and being highly efficient, skipping as many steps in the process that could get to the end result as fast as possible. When you move into quick start, it's really about how we handle risk and uncertainty. So 7, 8, 9, 10s in quick start experiment to get things done. They figure out, well, if I try this, or what if I try that, or what about this, or what about that? And it's really a very, all of them are incredibly powerful, but you do see a lot of entrepreneurs that really have a lot of quick start because they're trying to make something up and then make it real and then can face all kinds of risks in terms of, you know, putting their hosts on the line. And so you really see people who have that long quick start, highly experimental, willing to try things out, almost saying yes to things before they get a chance to even figure out if it was the right thing to say yes to, because they're just going to go, hey, whatever, let's see what happens. Short quick starts like you and your three do the opposite. You look at situations and you go, how can I make sure that if I'm going to tackle something, even if it's a huge change, that I do it in the safest, most protected way possible that stabilizes, gets me to the end result, and minimizes any kind of risk. And then on implementer, it's usually the hardest one for people to understand because it's about the need for things to be tangible. And so 7, 8, 9, 10s physically build things. They're very hands-on. They need things to have like an end result with quality that they can attest to. If they're in the medicine, they're going to be like hands-on microsurgeons. Or if they're in the arts, they probably are doing sculpture or photography or dance. Whereas someone who's sort of on the implementer, the 1, 2s, and 3s are highly conceptual and really understand things from an idea point of view, from a concept. I think about them a little bit like in The Matrix at the end of the first movie when Keanu Reeves sees The Matrix in his mind and he sees 1s and 0s. Short implementers, 1, 2s, and 3s, get things from an idea point of view. And what you'll find in the middle zone, and I don't want to ignore anybody who's a 4, 5, and 6, which is funny because I'm actually in the middle all the way along. We can do it either way. And I often think about 7, 8, 9, 10s in anything being like a gas pedal in a car, and 1, 2s, and 3s in anything being kind of like a brake in a car. They're both really strong. They just operate opposite of each other. And in the middles, it's like a stick shift in a standard car. You can gear up and be like the gas, or you can gear down and be like the brake. So you kind of have your choice. And you'll do it instinctively. You won't even think about it. And all of those can apply in some situations really well, and in other situations not so well. So it's about finding your best situation.
You're listening to Frankly MSP.
So your index is 6, 6, 4, 4. So that's 6 on FactFinder, 6 on follow-through, 4 on quick start, 4 on implementer, which kind of makes you a mediator, right?
It does. And in fact, the official term is mediator, and we also use facilitator to balance it off. And here's why I think it's so important to understand language. When people say mediator or facilitator, they think, oh, well, you must work really well in people context and kind of support people and be really nice. And you know me really well. No one ever says I'm really nice as the first thing they talk about. Direct, demanding, really clear, bossy, all those things come up. But my conative methodology, because those are all affective aspects, my conative methodology is to adapt to what everybody else needs. So as a 6 fact finder working with you as an 8 fact finder, I would just support your need to find lots of details and I would kind of answer all your questions. But as a 6 fact finder working with Wayne as a 3 fact finder, because we work and live together, I really support his need to kind of skim the surface on stuff. And what's really fascinating is I can do that in all the modes because I don't have a way I have to have things and I don't have a way that I counteract things. And that's what we call it, is initiate action or counteracting, that long and short. And so being a mediator is fantastic in the middle when you can react to other people or situations. But when there's nothing to react to, that can be really frustrating. So it's very fascinating to see that difference between how it shows up. And I'm even learning things like earlier this year, I had a really interesting interaction with Kathy Colby, where she was doing an exercise and I was getting really frustrated and I didn't know why I was so frustrated. And I decided not to play the exercise in the session. I'm just like, I'm not doing it. I'm going to be stubborn, obstinate. And she said, oh, yeah, it's really interesting. The mediators almost never play this exercise because there's no rules and nothing to react to. So there's nothing to connect with. And I don't want to forget that talked about conflict from difference. You can have a lot of conflict from competition when two people are really similar to each other. You can imagine you as an 8 fact finder talking to another 8 fact finder about which one of you was right on a research project. Well, we all know you're right, but the other person would think they're right too.
We've talked a little bit about this, but let's dig into it. What's the real difference between Colby and, say, a Myers-Briggs assessment or a DISC or any of the other sort of assessments you see out there?
So let's go back to that three parts of the human mind model. There's cognitive assessments, which are measuring things like, you know, are you a Mensa person? Can you pass their questionnaires? Did you pass your driver's license, your math class? All of that fits in the cognitive. So there's lots of cognitive testing. All the other ones you gave, Myers-Briggs, DISC, and there's literally probably about 3,000 of them in the world right now. MBTI, Myers-Briggs, and DISC have a lot of history. Myers-Briggs has been around over 100 years. And then Clifton Strengths by the Gallup organization has been around about 17 years. And it's actually got, you know, almost 20 million people have taken it. So those all fall in the affective side of how we operate. They're about our preferences and our personality. DISC specifically is a personality questionnaire about how we communicate. Myers-Briggs is a personality questionnaire about how we interact with others. StrengthsFinder is about how we actually go about enjoying certain things. Almost all of those questionnaires are affective. They can establish who you are at the time. They will drift a little bit more. But what I love about Colby is it has a 20-year test retest consistency. So it really measures this conative, how do you actually get things done based on the mental energy you have available? And what the really neat thing about it is, it's not correlated. Your Colby result on your conative mental energy is not correlated to parent to child, not even identical twins. Not your gender, terms male and female. It's not your race, the color of your skin. It's not your ethnicity. It's not where you were born in the world. And I can't tell you scientifically that you're born with it because you can't measure it in newborns because there's just not enough going on with them for you to be able to tell it. But by the time a child is 6 months old, you can measure their Colby in general terms through observational testing. By the time they're 10 years old, they can take a Colby Y, which is for youth, has different questions and the reports are a lot more kid-friendly. And by the time an adult is 20 years old, you've got a Colby A and it's highly predictive of their behavior and what they need. So this is such a foundational tool to go, you know, I may not like doing this, but I can do it because I have the mental energy for it versus I may love to do this or it's really important, but it stresses me because I don't have the mental energy to do it. So it's different.
So let's bring this down to specifics. If you get your Colby index done, how can you use this to sort of manage yourself and your work environment and your career?
There's a really good story I want to tell. It was a person that I knew who was another Colby consultant, because I'm an independent consultant, not part of the Colby organization. I'm a certified consultant. And there's a small group of us, about 400 or 500 in the world that have that designation. And there was a consultant that worked internally at Hershey, the chocolate company. He was a trainer. He was in their learning and development department. And he was a really good trainer and he loved it. And he was a long quick start and he was short on fact finder follow through. And so he had this really good job where he got to go into teams, figure out what was wrong with them or what they wanted to do differently, create a training program, run the training program, and then kind of move on. And it was perfect suited to how he did things, you know, short-term engagements, really exciting and new all the time. And then his boss, who was the manager of the department, was moving on to another role. And he said, I think you should take on my job. And he started looking at what he'd be doing day to day. And that job was more pay and it was the next step up the ladder, lots of good things. But the downside was that he was going to sit behind a desk. It was going to be a lot of budgeting, a lot of numbers, a lot of structure, a lot of strategic planning, a lot of doing the same, 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 and managing and holding a bunch of people around him accountable to getting these things. And he just looked at it and went, that's going to kill me. In corporate worlds or in lots of jobs, you have to be successful in your job in order to get the next opportunity. Well, that becomes a challenge when the job you take on is a job that doesn't suit you. And you can actually become physically ill. We had one guy that was in a large Canadian bank, and he literally was, after 6 months on the job, after he'd moved his family across the country to take on this new great role that was a breadth role, was being physically ill, like nauseous, punching the elevator button every day to go to work. It's not worth it. So managing yourself, making better choices, really deciding what your career should be, what your next job should be, or how you're really good at something and doing more and more of that in your own way is really, really important. And what's so funny is once you start to understand this about yourself and you can see where really it's a good fit for you, you can turn around and identify and appreciate the people around you that have things to do that are different than you, but can support you and you can support them. And there's great opportunities for turning this self-awareness into wonderful mutual understanding and great team effectiveness. So just like know this about yourself and do what you are, do you, and then that allows you to appreciate and interact with others that much better.
Taking it up a level to managers using Colby indexes for their team. So I'm listening to the story of the Hershey trainer and his boss offering him this job. It seems like his boss was not aware of the Colby index, otherwise he wouldn't have offered him that job. So what are some other ways that managers can use the Colby index to get better team performance?
Sure. And so what we look at often in the consulting we do is to try and help people to be not only themselves better and make better choices, but also exactly as you said, to make their managers understand them better. And so if you're working with people and thinking back to when you and I were working together and we would have, you know, two writers that might have had equal amounts of skill in writing, and yet we knew that we might give a particular assignment because there was no information to somebody that was really comfortable making up. I don't mean making up as in making it up unfactually, but being able to write something raw off of not a lot of data because they were well suited to that. But then we knew they were going to give us lots of grammatical errors and spelling errors and we were going to have to tidy it up. So we'd bring in a good editor that would then have the conative as well as the actual skills to kind of work through and tailor that versus something else where we go, this person, the client we're working with has like boxes of data and stuff that has to be winnowed down. And so they don't have to be imagining new things and coming up with new and innovating stuff. We would turn around and give it to a different writer that kind of could plow through it and edit it down. And so that's the same kind of choices that managers get to make. Who are you going to choose at certain points to give certain tasks to? And I think you're absolutely right. The manager at Hershey was offering someone, this consultant I knew, this job, probably because he'd been around in the department a long time, probably because it was a good, you know, it's the right thing to do in your career track to get to the next level, but it was the wrong thing for him to do. He ended up taking a lateral to a different part of the organization to a job that suited his conative talents, and he could keep growing his career by going up in a different way. Great managers need to find out what their people are really good at, and then remove any obstacles to them doing that as much as possible in their role as much as they can. And then to keep doing that with every single person, that creates longevity and it creates effectiveness.
Now, I know Colby can also be used during the hiring process, right? So it's one thing you've got this team before you and figuring out how you're best going to use their talents and conative instincts. But there's also the step back where you can say, who do I want to hire in based on what I need? So can you talk to us about that and sort of how you set that up and where it sits in the hiring process?
Sure. And so let me talk about where it sits in the hiring process and then I'll go into the other pieces. I look at the hiring process as having to tap into all three parts of the human mind. So the first thing that people always do, and it really works well, is they start with a job description, sort of the requirements of the job. And then they sometimes fill in some of the soft skills stuff they're looking for, but there's the hard skills that they need. And those hard skills are going to fall into the cognitive area of the human mind. What do you need to know? What skills you need to have? Do you have the talent for writing? Are you a good technical person? All of that kind of stuff. And so you do that screening of the resumes off of the job description. You know, do they suit? Does that make sense? Then I really recommend you do an initial but short telephone interview to tap into that sense of, do I like this person? Are they going to fit our culture? Do I think they're kind of interesting? Are they honest about their resume? All those things. And so I usually like to do a 15 to 20 minute telephone interview to just kind of filter and see what's going on. And that's an affective filter in terms of their personality, but you're also testing some of their knowledge potentially on the cognitive. And then we insert Colby to measure their conative right there. Because you don't want to get three interviews down the road and you love this person and then find out that they're just going to be having a hard time in the job and they're not going to be a good conative fit. And then once you filter your candidates based on conative fit, then you move on to full on, let's do the in-person interviews. Let's really get to know them, share them, and see if there's a really good affective filter again. The way the Colby process for hiring works, and it's unlike every other process, it is not that the others can't be effective, but it is 82% effective for a good long-term hire. There was a recruiting agency in the US that did 1,000 Colby A indexes, and I'm just going to say that A for a reason, Colby A index, about who their candidates were, and used Right Fit over a 3-year period. And most recruiters actually will give a 3-month guarantee when they're bringing someone into a job, because they know there's just attrition and poor fit, no matter what you do in terms of interviews and trying to filter people and screen them. They moved their guarantee up to a full year. And they were willing, with money back, replacement, everything, because they knew they were getting good cognitive fits and their people were staying longer in the job and even 2 years longer in the job. They were really seeing an incredible switch. And that's because there's the Colby A measures who we naturally are, all that we've been talking about. You're 8732, my 6644, all of that. But there's also a Colby C, which measures how someone who's managing us and supervising us, our direct supervisor manager, would see us successful in the job. And so what we use with Right Fit is we create a range of success. We have the manager fill out who they are. We have them fill out what they want for any one of the roles on their team, role by role, because it's not a one size fits all, unless you're trying to clone a whole bunch of people. And then you create a range of success. You can add more into it to make it more subtle. And then you screen your candidates against it and you get a letter grade. And the letter grade's anywhere from an A down to an F. And if they're not at least a B minus or higher for the role, they're going to struggle to complete the role in the way that the direct supervisor sees it being done. And so there's a bit more consulting and subtlety that goes into that. But what you're really looking at is a scientific measure that can be used in hiring that completely meets all of the requirements in Canada, United States, and around the world for good hiring practices and the law. And it's completely backed up by the science of saying, if you do these steps, Colby C and measuring the Colby A's against the range of success, you have an 82% or greater chance of a good long-term hire.
That's astonishing to me. Like, that's such a great success rate.
It's because you're tapping into the natural who they are. And again, I think about, like, imagine me again, I'm 6'4". And I'm in a grocery store and you tell me I need to stock all the shelves. Well, I'm going to stock all the top ones really efficiently. But if you tell me I have to stock all the bottom ones, I'm going to be on my hands and knees. I'm going to have to scuttle along the floor. I'm going to be dragging boxes and trying to fill in things and I can't see very well. But you tell me it's my job, so I do it. Or you can hire me to do all the top shelves and you can partner me with somebody who's 5 foot or 4 foot or 3 foot. They can do all the bottom shelves. It's not that I can't bend down, and it's not that you can hire somebody who's like 4 foot to stock shelves and they could go up a ladder all the time. But that's not making either of us efficient in our natural abilities and matching them to the role.
So we've covered quite a bit in this conversation today. If you want MSPs to take away one thing to know about Colby, what would it be?
I would say that the key thing that I always think about, and I got this directly from Kathy Colby, and she says it all the time, know yourself and give yourself the freedom to do things your way. And freedom is really the key word. It's not that you can't force yourself to do things. There might be a really good reason to force yourself or a really good feeling to force yourself, but give yourself the freedom to do things your own way. Understand that getting to the result is the important part of something. Thinking about Google Maps, you punch in a Google Map destination, there's like 5-6 ways to get there. There's 3 driving, there's a transit, there's a walking, there's a biking. Pick the one that works best for you and get to the destination. Match your way of doing things and the permission you give yourself to your methodology. And Kathy Colby always talks about this. She says, be obstinate in being yourself. And in fact, she's just, funny enough, started a podcast this week called Perfectly Obstinate People, which I think is awesome. I've listened to the first one and it's great. And I can't wait to hear more because it's very her. Anytime I talk to someone about this, and I've talked to thousands of people around the world for over 20 years, is they're just like, wow, I mean, I get to be me. I don't have to be somebody else. I don't have to present the way someone tells me to. I don't have to preach my sermons the way someone tells me or prepare for those. I don't have to do this job this way. It's like, no, do it your way and focus on the result.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ross.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me. I really appreciate the opportunity to reconnect with you on this.
That was Ross Slater, partner and VP at Reach Capabilities. I'll put links to all of the Colby resources we talked about, as well as Kathy Colby's new podcast and Ross's website and contact info if you want to get in touch with him, in today's show notes at ovic.com/franklymsp/032. And that's a wrap. Remember to subscribe to Frankly MSP wherever you get your podcasts for each episode as it drops. Till next time, this is Jennifer Tribe. Thanks for listening.
Frankly MSP, brought to you by Ovic Networks, the most efficient and profitable way to manage your clients' networks.